Welcome to Sunday Morning, a news and public affairs programming service of Cox Media Group. I'm your host, Mimi Lawson, and my honored guest this morning, Dr. Heidi Kellogg. She's the Director of Pediatric Emergency Medicine at Florida Hospital. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me today.
Well, I'm glad to have you here. We've done a lot of interviews in the past with Florida Hospital in Tampa, and one of the reasons why is that you guys have an awesome community outreach. Why do you do some of the events that you do?
Well, you know, honestly, a lot of why we all became, you know, doctors and nurses and such is to really go out and help people. And we have a very limited audience with who comes into the ER every day. And we know that a lot of things, you know, that come into the ER, you know, they're really scary for people. And if we can get out and do that outreach and get out to the people who are out there and let them know when they need to be here, when they don't need to be here, when to be scared and when not to be scared. You know, at the end of the day, it's just about extending what we can do just beyond the doors of the hospital.
Well, I know before Obamacare became a law, there were a lot of people that didn't have the insurance that they needed to go see a doctor. And I think that a lot of those events that you did were great for that reason, because it got people in that wouldn't have had that access to medical care. But even now, you guys continue to do those things.
We do. And, you know, especially in emergency medicine, I mean, we're used to taking care of people regardless of insurance. You know, one of the things I love about my job is I never know, you know, if somebody's Medicare or Medicaid or, you know, Blue Cross or any of these other companies. I have no idea. You know, we treat people based on, you know, what they come in for and what their major complaint is or what they're scared or worried about. We don't really care about who's paying the bill.
Mm-hmm. Do you have events coming up that specifically where you're doing some of those community outreach? Or are we just going to really talk about the pediatric emergency medicine today?
We do have an event coming up. It's going to be on September 17th at Tampa Palms Golf and Country Club. It'll be from 6 to 8 p.m. And our theme, this is part of our Passport to Health Women's Seminar Series. And this one, the theme is going to be on your child's health care matters, choosing the right level of care for your kids. And, you know, this is, you know, something to get, you know, mothers, fathers, grandparents, aunts, you know, what have you, and to talk about, you know, when do you go to your regular pediatrician? You know, when do you need to come to the ER? You know, when is a phone call enough? You know, when do you really need to come in? And really try to debunk some of that and make people feel more comfortable about utilizing the healthcare system for their children.
And this event, like you said, is on the 17th. And again, what time is it?
It's going to be from 6 to 8 p.m.
So great. That's after work. I was thinking it was going to be during the day. It makes sense.
Yeah.
It makes sense. I know that when you do these, that you have screenings, that you're available. A lot of the doctors are there available to go over those tests that you've done. You're going to have doctors here besides yourself, I take it.
We are, yes.
Emergency pediatric medicine. You got into this because you loved kids and, you, as you say, a lot of doctors. And it's nice to hear you say that, because I think there's people out there that think, oh, that some reason that anybody gets into a business like being a doctor that you can make a lot of money at is just for that reason. It's nice to hear you say that isn't the reason.
It is. And it's the reason why I got into pediatric care originally was I was working or training as a, you know, as a primary emergency physician, you know, being able to see both adults and children. And something that I realized is a lot of other doctors are uncomfortable taking care of children. And I wanted to go ahead and take the extra time in training to get better at managing children and understanding, you know, why they're different from adults and why it makes a difference to have a specialty provider. And to me, that was worth some extra time in training. And, you know, that's for us, you know, taking extra training time, you know, that's working crummy hours and time away from families. But it's really important, because I never wanted to have a child come through the door and have me scratching my head saying, I don't know what to do with this, and how am I going to communicate this to the family? You know, I've got to be able to be there for every child that comes through there through the room. And to me, that was worth the long hours and the extra time.
Well, and I know that it's scary for anybody to go to the emergency room, but it's got to be even more so for a child to come in there.
Oh, absolutely. It's, you know, you're dealing with double anxiety. You have the parents that are really scared, and you have the children that are really scared. And a lot of what we do is, you know, we focus a lot on the child, but the family is part of that. That's a big part of the child's life. And it's double duty, but it's also doubly rewarding.
When kids do come in there, obviously you've got a different set of protocols that you go at children, different attitude that you go at children. What are some of the special things that you've learned or the things that you guys use that you think helps put some of those kids at ease?
I'll give you an example. You know, something that we see very commonly are children that fall and hurt themselves on the playground. A lot of times, you know, they'll break their forearm, and there's two bones in the forearm, and they'll come in and their arm might be bent at a funny direction, which is very scary, as you can imagine, for the child and for the parent. And when they come into our doc first ER, they're seen by a physician as soon as they come in, and we've written a protocol by which They're given medication intranasally, so we don't have to stick them with needles or wait for an oral medicine to take effect.
Awesome.
The nasal medicine takes effect within a couple of minutes. We put a radiolucent splint on them, which is, it doesn't change what the x-rays look like. And we get them over to x-ray, and they're able to get their films done with a lot less pain and a lot less, you know, anxiety and everything like that. And then when we get them back and we're ready to talk about the fracture, the child's already more comfortable, and we've already defused a lot of that double anxiety, you know, just again with a simple protocol and getting them involved from as soon as they walk in through the door.
And do you talk to children about it and show them their x-rays and show them what bones and help educate them as well? Do you find that that maybe kind of eases some of that anxiety?
You know, it does, especially with the older children. You know, it's very age dependent. Mm-hmm. You know, it just depends. As children, you know, develop, they develop an awareness of where their body parts are and kind of, you know, what's what. Mm-hmm. A lot of times with that's letting the parents know, okay, hey, this is why this is here. And more importantly, here's what we have to do about it. You know, is your child going to need surgery? Is this something that, you know, we can put them to sleep for a few minutes here in the ER and fix, and just explain to the parents again, you know, just defusing anxiety. That's a lot of what we do.
Mm-hmm. I'll bet you that actually the bigger problem is the parents, isn't it?
Not always. Not always.
But, no. Yeah. So as far as pediatric emergency medicine, you come in just to the emergency room, but that then they're specifically seen by one of your doctors. There's not
Correct.
A separate room, right?
Well, we have an area that's dedicated to children right now. We have rooms here at Florida Hospital Tampa that use something called the Philips Experience System. And so we can change the colors of the rooms. We can project fish and jungle scenes and
cool.
rocket ships and things like that onto the wall. But what we're actually really excited about is on March 1st, we're planning on opening our new Doc First Pediatric ER, which is going to be absolutely phenomenal. You're going to be coming on board our Florida Hospital Tampa pirate ship, and we are taking things into a whole new direction as far as patient and parent immersion, and just really, you know, teaching children that coming to the hospital, you know, when you're sick, you know, it's already a bummer that you're sick, but there's nothing wrong with having an absolutely wonderful adventure while you're sick. And that just makes it so much easier for them. And it makes it more comfortable for them when they come back the next time and they say, hey, mommy, I don't feel well. They don't have this memory of going to the hospital and, you know, having this terrible experience that makes them not want to tell their parent later on when something's wrong.
Well, that makes sense. You just said that there's this certain protocol. What did you call that?
The Doc First Pediatric ER.
Oh, yeah. But then you were talking about something after that. You said you're able to change the fish on the wall and everything, and you called that something else.
Oh, yeah. That's a Philips Experience.
Yeah. What is that?
That's actually a system that we have in the rooms right now. It's a big projector up in the ceiling and also in the wall. In the ceiling projector, we actually can change the color of the ambient light of the room, and that will change based on themes. And the themes also project onto the wall. Like if I went in over to room 6 right now, room 6, if I look over there now, we currently have dolphins and stingrays swimming across the wall, and it's a beautiful blue-green color that variates with the light, and it's very soothing.
Who came up with this?
There's lots of people out there, lots of ideas. I mean, Philips is a very big medical company, and this is a system that they've developed. It's in use in a couple of other Florida hospital ERs, and it's, you know, again, a lot of this is, you know, us as a society realizing that medicine, it's not just about, you know, needles and sutures and medicines and everything else. A lot of it is, you know, in presentation and in recognizing that, you know, how people feel when they're receiving care is a big part of that care. You know, again, it's building that trust and it's building that confidence that when I come here, I am going to be cared for and I am going to feel better. And even if I have something that may be incurable and may be horrible, you know, at the very least, I know that there's going to be staff and surroundings where I'm going to feel comfortable and I'm going to feel safe. I mean, what we do here is, you know, in a very short period of time, we have to go in and get people to tell us things that they may not even want to tell their closest friends and family. Mm-hmm. And we have to establish that rapport, and making people feel safe and comfortable is a big part of that.
Well, and I've seen that in dentist's office and some of the things that they've done. Even my chiropractor, I noticed that they have really decorated their whole office differently than most of any doctor's office I've seen. And I'll tell you, even as an adult, it makes a difference.
It does.
When you went to medical school, I'm guessing, I don't know how long ago that was, and I'm not asking you to give away your age, but these kind of protocols were not in effect. I think this is a fairly new thing. How have you seen it change patients' reactions?
Well, I remember when I was serving as an ER volunteer in college in Virginia, I actually remember us talking about a case where there was a little guy, he was 5 years old, and he had caught his finger. I guess he had been picking up a bookshelf at school, and he'd caught his fingernail, and it had torn the fingernail, and the fingernail had to be taken off. And I remember them talking about how it took 10 people to hold this little guy down.
Ooh.
And, you know, that was something that, you know, that was what you did. You know, there wasn't a lot of, you know, we didn't have a lot of specific pediatric practitioners. And a lot of what we do, you know, involves using sedative medications, you know, to make children more relaxed and to feel better. But for physicians, there's a lot of, you know, I guess, anxiety and trepidation about, you know, utilizing those medicines on children because, you know, people are like, hey, I'm, you know, I see mostly grown-ups. This isn't something I do every day. And this is something that's best done by people who come in and every day that we come to work, you know, we take care of children and we develop that level of comfort. And once you develop that level of comfort, you're able to start thinking outside the box as far as new ways to make this easier on the patient and parent.
Well, and I never would have thought the nasal way of giving medication. It never even occurred to me. Obviously, I'm not a doctor, but man, that what a great idea, because I don't like needles. I can't imagine a five-year-old would be very happy about it.
No, they're not at all. And when we do have to do IVs, we're actually about to roll out using a new device called the J-tip, which allows us to make a little numb area of skin on their arm. And this is done by, it's a little bit of air pressure. There's no needle required. We get them nice and numb there. Takes it just a few seconds rather than injecting them with medicine or with other things that we've used in the past, a cream that can take, you know, 30 to 45 minutes. And then we're able to start an IV again with just minimal pain. And it's really, if you can take a lot of the pain out of the equation, it's much easier for the child because they get themselves worked up and they think, oh my gosh, this is really going to hurt. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, you poke them or you suture them and they're like, oh, that wasn't so bad.
Right.
You know?
And, you know, I think you're also setting up, I can remember my mother, for example, had a real issue with going to the dentist, and she would never let us go to the dentist with her because she didn't want us to see and then have that experience that going to the dentist was a painful, scary thing. I think that you, by doing this as children, are also setting up a lifelong experience for them about going to the doctor.
Right. That's the idea. We need to build that culture of trust. I think Americans in general are very uncomfortable with their healthcare system. You know, there's a lot of negativity. It's all a lot of, you know, how much is it going to cost and is this going to hurt and am I going to take this medicine and am I going to feel terrible? And then there's a culture of people feeling like, you know, they don't really know what's going on and there's not a lot of transparency. And you know, we can't fix all of those problems, you know, in our PDR. We really can't. But we can at least try to, you know, just develop that level of trust where when you come to the hospital that you feel like we are really trying to and are going to help you rather than harm you or make your life more difficult or anything like that. And if we can build that, I think, from a young age, you know, it's something, you know, it's playing the long game, but it's completely worth it.
Well, I think so, too. I have a friend who is very reluctant as an adult to go to the doctor. He's completely scared that what he may find out. And I have said time and time again to this, that how do you know that it isn't something, if you've waited 2 years to go and check something out, that in that 2 years, if it ends up being something serious, that if you'd have gone in the beginning, couldn't have been dealt with more easily than the disease progressing. And I think that that's exactly what we're talking about here. More preventative medicine almost.
Right. And a lot of pediatrics is just that. You know, we'll talk about, you know, if a child comes in and they fall and they've hit their head because they're riding their bike and they weren't wearing a helmet, we'll talk about wearing the helmet next time, you know, preventing that next head injury, you know,
right.
Car accidents, you know, hey, was your child in a booster seat? Were they in a rear-facing car seat? You know, again, just getting that education, that information out there, because honestly, you know, nobody really likes seeing children get hurt and nobody really likes seeing children that get sick, but it's going to happen. But if we can cut down on those preventable things, that's a lot about, you know, you talked about community outreach at the beginning of this, and that's a big part about what community outreach does is if we can say, hey, you know something, we can prevent a lot of head injuries in children. If you guys are wearing helmets, hey, we don't mind losing that business. We'll
right.
find something else to do, you know,
yeah, <exactly. laughs>
we'd much rather not have kids cracking their heads open.
Right. In the time that you have been a doctor and you've seen a lot of these protocols change, I know I don't want a conversation about Obamacare or, you know, how the healthcare system is or is not and who it serves. But how have you seen the people that are providing those healthcare? Have you seen a real change in empathy?
I have. And I think a lot of it depends on where you go. You know, there was a time it really wasn't that long ago when, you know, a doctor could just walk in and say, hey, we're doing this and you have to take it or you can just
not.
Right. And, you know, even in the early time of my training, that was still an attitude that went on. And, you know, in some places, I think it still goes on. But, you know, here it doesn't. And it's a matter of, again, you cannot build trust if you have to engage people. You have to make people feel like they are a partner in their healthcare. And you know, a partnership, a marriage, a good relationship, anything like that, it does not start off with, you are going to take this and you're going to put up with this and I'm not going to explain it and you're just going to do it because I told you you have to do it.
Yeah.
No relationship starts well that way. And I think we're just, you know, we're recognizing that and we're realizing that, and people are asking for it. You know, they want to know more of what's going on. They want to know, hey, why are you doing this to my child? Or, hey, I feel like this about my child and I feel like you're not telling me enough. I need to know more. And we're answering that call now. We're not just ignoring it anymore.
And I think it's a wonderful trend in healthcare. I'm really excited about seeing that. On Thursday night when we go there, kind of walk us through us. Do we have to register? And what can we expect when we get there?
To register, there's two ways to do it. You can either call area code 813-615-7300, or you can go to our website, which is floridahospital.com/Tampa, and you'll be able, there'll be a link there and you can click on this. And as far as things to expect, I think what you can expect is a good conversation with some, you know, some physicians that are really, we're just, you know, none of us are, like I said before, none of us are getting paid to do this. This is something that we're doing because we feel like we need to invest in the community and we need to invest in our patient population. So you're going to come there and you're going to expect to have a good conversation, have a good time, be able to ask questions, hopefully get most of them answered, and have some great food.
It is, but you know, it's been a great conversation with you about this. First of all, like I say, I am really pro Florida Hospital and have been in the past because of the things that I see them do, like these events. They're free events. People can come out when they're not in a stressful situation. They're not in the middle of a broken arm or whatever might be the situation, and have conversation with the doctors. I mean, we really do have more choices now. It's nice that we're able to get this relationship built before we need a doctor, and then, you know, have some idea what's going on before we would even enter that emergency room.
I agree. Yeah. I think this is a great place to work. It's been a great place to practice as a physician. And yeah, it's a great time to get meet different kinds of doctors. I mean, you know, I don't work in primary. You know, you're not going to come to my clinic. I'm not going to see you in a low stress environment.
Right.
If I see you and you come to the ER, we're going to be chatting in the ER, you know. So one of the great forums is you're getting access to physicians and specialties where we may not necessarily be easy to get a hold of or easy to find or just to ask a question or something like that. And that's something that they try to do, is they try to really engage all the different medical specialties and really give people exposure to that.
Well, and I would think, too, that having some, pre-experience with, you walk into the emergency room and say they see you that night and they have the broken arm, but if they've seen you 2 months or even a year before that in an open forum like this, then immediately there is going to be some more relaxation and trust than there would be in that stressful situation.
We certainly hope so.
Yeah.
That's the idea.
Okay. Well, we're looking forward to seeing you. My guest this morning has been Dr. Heidi Kellogg. She's the director of the Pediatric Emergency Medicine. I'm going to mess that up every time. Emergency Medicine at Florida Hospital. Thursday night, the 17th, we'll see you there.
Okay. Wonderful. Hope to see everybody there.
Welcome to Sunday Morning, a news and public affairs programming service of Cox Media Group. I am your host, Mimi Lawson, and I have Petra, and I've already told her she's going to have to pronounce her own last name for me.
Vibiralova.
And I would have never said it that way. So you're the coordinator for the Safe Kids in Pinellas County. Is that what your title is?
My title is Safe Kids Coalition Coordinator for Pinellas County, but I also work with Pasco, Polk counties, and Sarasota and Manatee as well. I lead the coalitions in those counties as well. And that just shows you how big of an outreach we do here at All Children's with the Safe Kids Suncoast Coalition. So we serve 5 counties.
I was going to say, you must be a very busy person.
Oh, yes, absolutely. And different counties also have different needs. So I travel between the counties. So I find myself in Lakeland and then in Sarasota, then in St. Pete. Yes, I travel quite a bit.
Let's talk about what Safe Kids is. Safe Kids is the name of this nonprofit. And what do they do?
Safe Kids Coalition is part of an injury prevention nation or worldwide injury prevention organization called Safe Kids Worldwide. And they're based in Washington, D.C., and then they have state level. So our state of Florida, is based in Tallahassee, and then they have local organizations leading the local efforts. So All Children's Hospital is the leading organization for Safe Kids Florida Suncoast.
When you reach out to these different counties and to these different communities, what kind of services are you providing these kids? What are you trying to accomplish in these counties?
The coalition and the Safe Kids Worldwide is a coalition to prevent injuries. And what we did at the beginning of the year of 2015 with our local coalition, we really looked at the injury data for our counties, and we were astounded to realize they actually are sort of a tip of an iceberg of the national trends. So our, depending on the age group, but we decided on four main focuses for our area because that's where we saw the largest number of injuries. And those focuses are motor vehicle crashes, and that includes child passenger safety, car seats, booster seats, but also teen driving. And we also do water safety efforts, and our committees or water safety efforts include the Water Watcher program, always designate a person to watch the kids and the water at a party or at a large gathering. We do door alarms, boating safety with life jackets. We do beach giveaways, beach rentals for life jackets. And we also partnered up with our trauma program to do door alarm giveaways as well. And swim lessons, of course, with the YMCAs and the City of St. Petersburg. So the coalition is truly also a partner kind of umbrella coming together to prevent this. And then our next effort is bicycle pedestrian safety. So we ensure children know how to ride bicycles safely, how to wear helmets, how to walk safely, how to cross the road safely, look left, right, left, etc. And lastly, we also focus on suffocation because that is a large number of children, and that has to do with safe sleep, also toy safety, etc.
Are you finding that Florida, I know that Florida is big in drowning deaths with children. Finding that Florida is huge in these other areas as well?
So bicycle pedestrian is heavy in Florida. Motor vehicle crashes. We just recently got a booster seat law, we just recently have gotten improved a child restraint law. But prior to that improvement, Florida had the number one worst car seat law in the country. So obviously our children were getting hurt more. Or possibly more. I don't know the statistic, but we're essentially put in a more vulnerable position as of because of this law.
Right.
And, you know, drownings, of course, without a doubt, there's water everywhere, bicycle, pedestrian, yes. Yes, maybe we do have issues, but what we did, we really focused in our area. So what issues we have in our areas, and that's why I'm not quite as familiar how we compare to Alabama or, yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, let's talk about these four areas that you mentioned. Let's start with drownings, because not a lot of people, or maybe not everybody who's listening, is able to come out to events that you may have or be had you come to their community. Where do we start? How do we prevent drownings? Is there a checklist for us to go down?
So I would say a lot of times, what we like to make parents or caregivers or adults aware that childhood drownings and drownings in general can be absolutely silent. So there is a misperception that is sometimes portrayed by the media, by films, by movies, where the person in the media is drowning and they're coming up and screaming, where in the matter of fact, if let's say 3-year-old falls into a pool, they try to pedal really hard, and if they come up, they just catch a breath of water, which is silent, and they go back under. If they even come back up. But if they come up, they don't make any noise.
I see.
We do have something called 5 layers of protection. And that we look at when we try to prevent these drownings. And as we say, there are 5 layers of protection. It has to do with layers of preventing the child from accessing the pool, right?
Okay.
So we say one of the layers is the supervision, but we don't mean that if your child falls into the pool, you don't watch your child. It means to have an active watcher. So let's say you and I go to a party somewhere, and there are a bunch of adults and there's barbecue, designate that one person who will watch the water for the next 15 minutes. And if they are going inside, please pass this role on to somebody else. So there's somebody actually actively watching the kids. Because at parties, there's this tendency, everybody thinks everybody's watching, but nobody's like really watching, right?
Right.
So that's one. Inside of the home, what parents and caregivers can do is have a clear view of the pool from the house. Also, they can put up door alarms, right?
Mm-hmm.
It can be either in a form of a house security system, or various retailers sell door alarms that you can put on with the double sticky tape, and they just chime as somebody exits the house. So I have met families who said, oh, I was just cooking dinner. I thought she was watching TV. But they didn't realize the child had gotten out.
Mm-hmm.
So if they open the door and the alarm chimes, it lets you know the door is open. If wind opens it, it's okay, you close it, that's it, right?
Right.
But if in that situation that the child could be possibly moving, then it alerts you or alerts the caregiver that the child is moving. Also, we have a tendency to encourage everyone who has a pool or is near one or they keep attractive objects to children, like toys and balls and et cetera, out of the pool when they are not using it. Use the pool, clean it out, because the child can wander simply because they want that item.
Oh, yeah, that makes sense.
Mm-hmm, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then if they then try to reach for that item, they can fall in. Make sure the pools are covered. And also, of course, we tend to encourage pool fins with a self-latching gate. And it should be 4 to 5 feet tall.
Well, isn't there a law that there has to be a gate or a fence around new pools?
Right, but around new pools is the key.
Right, because mm-hmm. some of them are grandfathered in and they don't have to
exactly.
have those. Right.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah. And we also want to encourage parents and caregivers to have children attend swim lessons, formal swim lessons at the YMCA.
That makes so much sense, and you would think most parents would do that.
Sure,
or teach them themselves.
Mm-hmm. But yes, absolutely. But the most vulnerable group is that group from 1 to 4.
Oh,
right?
I see. Right.
And with that group, it's not really a reliable form of protection. So while they may know at 2, they may not swim during the winter. Will they remember by 3? You know, so I would
right.
still, I would still
continue to update that training.
Well, first of all, continue to update the training, but I would definitely include the other layers
of
besides
course.
Swim lessons.
Because of course.
Even somebody shared with me that they were at a party and they were fifth graders jumping in and nobody noticed. They all swam, but nobody noticed that 2 of them bumped each other.
Oh, and hit their heads.
Nobody knew how it happened. They just
right.
noticed somebody on the bottom of the pool, right?
Wow. Mm-hmm.
So this is not, I would suggest not to rely on swim lessons and swimming alone.
Exactly, exactly.
Right.
And that's for adults,
right.
too. If you get knocked out, you're going to drown. If you are on a boat, if you are in an accident,
right.
If you do not have a life preserver on.
Absolutely, absolutely. And we actually are fortunate enough to have and you reminded me because you said it can happen to adults, adult swimmer. We have a fishing tournament which is actually currently coming up that funds our life jackets, and it's called Fireman John Fishing Tournament. And what they do, the fishing tournament donates money for life jackets because the Fireman John fell off a boat and drowned because he didn't have a life jacket, and they should be U.S. Coast Guard approved. So again, this is somebody who was probably fit, skilled swimmer, right?
Right. And still drowned.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Let's move on to, you say we got a new law now in the state of Florida that strengthens mm-hmm. the law that we already had about car seats. Now, mm-hmm. what is the difference? They have to, the kids have to be in seats longer than they were before?
So the children should be in car seats. Well, so our law is still not in what American Academy of Pediatrics recommends the best practice, right? It's simply to strengthen it a little better. So in Florida, children are required to be in a restrained device up till their sixth birthday.
Okay, 6 years old.
Six years old, when they turn 6 years old. However, the best practice for parents is to keep them in a child restraint, and then can be a booster seat or a car seat, depending on how the child fits, based on their weight and height, until they are about 4 feet 9 inches tall.
Mm-hmm. So it really doesn't matter on the age anymore.
No, because if you think about it, and this is really, I always love hearing this, just like clothes that are made for adults don't fit kids properly, the right. seat belts are actually made for an adult passenger.
Right. And that's how a lot of kids get killed. They might be in a seatbelt, but because the seatbelt hits them in the wrong area because they're not as big, it can actually harm them more than it can help them, correct?
Right, right. The, I don't know that it's more than it can help them because that's debatable, but it can certainly cause injury, let's say, to their abdomen. Mm-hmm. So the best way to try your child if they're sitting properly is, are they able to sit with their back against the vehicle seat? Does the seatbelt go over their collarbone and their lower thighs or the hip bones? Do their knees bend over the edge of the seat when they are sitting?
And
that is sort of the true measure of whether the seatbelt fits correctly or not. Mm. And beforehand, because if they are unable to bend their knees over the edge of the seat, sometimes they slouch, right?
Right.
Which moves that lap belt portion of that belt over their stomach. One of the significant injuries that can be suffered is certainly brain trauma. 767-8581.